On this week's episode of Work Trends, we're talking love, relationships, and work with Jason Lauritsen. Welcome to the Work Trends podcast from Talent Culture. I'm your host, Megan Mbiro. Every week, I interview interesting people and brands who are reimagining work. For more information, be sure to check us out at talentculture.com and join us live on Twitter every Wednesday at 1:30 p.m. Eastern using the hashtag WorkTrends. Thank you for listening to the Work Trends podcast. Now we want to hear from you and what you think about the podcast, what you like, what topics you want us to cover in 2019, and where you think the world of work is going. Please take our very brief feedback survey today and tell us what you think. The survey is live and available at talentculture.com/survey. Thanks again for tuning in. I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Kevin W. Grossman.
Hi, Megan. I'm so excited for a super duper happy fun day holiday Christmas time.
Okay. I gather you like the holidays.
Yes, indeed. Just as much as my children do. In fact, it's not just about the getting. We're also teaching them to give back. The past few years, we've adopted a family traumatized by domestic violence, and we buy gifts for them. It's a little something we can do. We've done that for the past few years.
Oh, that's awesome. What a wonderful lesson for your kids. That's amazing.
Yeah, we want them to be their best selves in life and give back when they can for those who need it.
And speaking of best selves in the light of any circumstance, today we're talking about helping employees reach their full potential.
That's right. Now, recently, I saw the managing director at Willis Towers Watson speak at a Bay Area event right before Thanksgiving. And his latest book published in September is titled Reinventing Jobs, A Four-Step Approach for Applying Automation to Work. So we're going to mix a little bit of HR technology and technology, as well as making ourselves our best selves at work today. So he talked about how we rethink the workforce while allowing technology to empower it further. This included a case study about the oil and gas industry, which I found fascinating. So traditionally, oil rig workers must be on site doing very hands-on, laborious work, right? It's often very dangerous. I can't even imagine. However, technology today is making it possible to create a completely autonomous rig, which I was like blown away by this. And Megan, we both know how smart technologies are truly changing the world of work landscape today.
You don't have to tell me twice, but you still need humans to run the world.
Correct. So instead of fixating on eliminating the human labor altogether, this oil and gas company set out to optimize their human talent, shifting employees away from repetitive, physical, isolated, and dangerous work toward more variable, mental, interactive, and less hazardous work. And this is what this individual was sharing at the event I went to. They reinvented their rig crews to provide many of the services that before had been provided by third parties, offering a complete oil field management solution. I just was, again, blown away by this example. These newly reinvented jobs required increasing pay levels by between 7 and 15%, and it produced a 45% increase in profitability and a significant reduction in performance variance between rigs. All in told, it was all about making their workers, reinventing them, making them their best selves at work while automating this rig. I just found that fascinating.
Those are huge wins. Let's talk to our first guest more about how performance management can unlock big wins for employers today. Our first guest is my friend Jason Lauritsen. He has spent his career trying to make work better, first as an entrepreneur, then as a corporate HR pro, and now he's a famous consultant and speaker. He's the author of the new book, Unlocking High Performance, How to Use Performance Management to Engage and Empower Employees to Reach Their Full Potential. Welcome to Work Trends, Jason.
Hey, Megan. Thanks for having me.
You got it. Okay, Jason, so your new book is all about unlocking people's potential at work. What inspired you to write about this topic?
If I was going to write about anything, it seemed like this is kind of what it had to be. I think everything in my work comes back to this somehow. Finding a way to actually get the workplace out of the way of our potential is where I think I spend most of my time. I call that employee engagement. Other people call it different things. But yeah, this particular book, it actually didn't set out interestingly, to write a book about performance. This ended up being a book about performance, but that wasn't where I started. I started thinking about engagement and some other things. And as we sort of surveyed what was happening in the workplace and in the marketplace and what people seemed to be struggling with, it seemed to me that in this point in time or this time in history that we've got this narrative going on around performance appraisals and how much they suck and all that being broken. And there was sort of a void of, most of the conversation ends up being about technology or process and not really about human performance. And in my mind, there's not a difference between what I have been doing. I call it employee engagement, but employee engagement, the purpose of employee engagement is to fuel better performance or to unlock performance. And so it seemed like the right place to be and the right language to be using. And frankly, framing employee experience and employee engagement in context of importances or in context of performance is really critical because, let's be honest, executives don't really care about engagement. They care about performance.
That's a really good point, by the way.
And so that's why it ended up being packaged the way it is. And at the time, I don't know that I really understood how powerful and important that was until I got into the book and started writing it. And then it really made sense as it came together.
Well, and now CEOs might actually read your book, let's be honest.
Well, that's what I'm hoping. CEOs, managers, right? anybody that can affect the work experience of others and has a vested interest in seeing higher performance, right? That's who I'm hoping will pick it up.
I love the fact that you're like, I'm still going to call it employee engagement for all you people out there who want to call it all these other words. The bottom line is if you're not performing, you're not going to have a job.
Right. Well, and the other part of that is that performance is the organizational imperative. Right, you don't need a perform or an organization of any sort, whether it's for profit, non for profit. Without the performance imperative, you don't need to exist. We have to produce a product or a service that is of value to someone else, and without that performance, you don't need to be around, and you'll go away. So that's the lifeblood, right? That's the oxygen, the blood, whatever that keeps the organization alive. And so everything is about performance, and we lose that sometimes. I mean, I think that's where engagement has gotten such a bad rap over the years is the way we talk about it in HR and in other places. It feels like a kumbaya, touchy-feely kind of thing. It's like, that's not, it is. It's about human emotion and all of those things. But when we're all said, and when it all the smoke clears from all the confusion we create, it still has to be about performance. Otherwise, it doesn't matter.
You're all about making work better. You and I have been both in the trenches as well as in the world of digital media, right? Talking about these topics for like a decade now. Early in the book, you say work is a relationship, not a contract. And this is something that's always stood out to me in some of your writing and how you are living out what you're inspired by. Tell us what you mean by this.
It's more so something that kind of emerged, I guess, for me, and that I don't believe that it's a matter of opinion. I think it's a matter of actual fact that work is a relationship for the employee. The employee experiences work as a relationship. So let me back up a little bit. What I started to realize as I was doing research for best places to work when I was in one of my prior lives. Mm-hmm. We were looking at all this data. When you look at sort of macro level data for employee engagement, no matter where you are, whether it's the stuff I was looking at or Gallup or anybody else, the same kinds of things are always bubbling to the surface in terms of what drives employee engagement, what drives employees to higher performance, higher contribution. It's things like feeling valued and trust and knowing someone at work cares about me and feeling appreciated and all those things. And those are relational constructs. And so when you look at that through the lens of the employee is looking for work to feel like a relationship. And when it feels like a healthy relationship, then I'm motivated to higher performance. The problem is the way our workplaces are oriented is around, we think about work as a contract with the employee and we treat it as a contract with the employee. And if you need any evidence of that, just look at our HR processes, job descriptions, policy manuals, performance appraisals, performance improvement plans. It's all about making sure the organization is getting their money's worth out of what the employee owes them, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have that break where I'm an employee showing up to work wanting to be in relationship with my organization and my work, and I get treated like I'm in a contractual relationship, and all I hear is compliance-driven messaging and have compliance-driven interactions. It's like, no wonder engagement mm-hmm. sucks. No wonder it feels gross, right?
Yeah, that's, right.
That's what's
a good
broken.
Word, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I use big, complicated words.
No, I love it. It's like gross, hashtag gross. How's that for today? Right. Why not?
I love it.
It's all about creating healthy relationships.
It is.
And I think that scares, frankly, a lot of people.
No
I don't
doubt.
Know why, but we're still having this conversation, Jason.
Well, I think it's because I think as a general rule, we aren't great at relationships. I mean, if you look at, you know, go look at divorce rates, go look at how people are interacting with each other in social media and look at the national discourse and the decline of trust and all this. Like we're not doing a good job of helping people learn how to be in relationship with one another. And so you come into the workplace, the stakes are higher, there's money involved now. It just amplifies how much we suck at relationships mm-hmm. at times. So I think one of the things that I'm hoping will happen as a result of the book as people read it is they really think about relationship and start investing in their skills related to relationship and how to be in relationship with other human beings more effectively and in a more healthy way, because that'll not only improve work, but it'll improve your whole life.
A lot of our listeners, I think it's safe to say, are in the middle of major transformations right now. In the HR tech space, we focus a lot on how technology is transforming. But you point out that we need to think about behavior transformation too. What are the old school HR practices that we have to let die or that we have to change?
Is it flippant to say all of them? I think
truthful.
Yeah, I think that's probably a little too critical, but so much of going back to what I just said, so many of these systems and processes are oriented in or built on work as a contract as a model, and the way that we approach it is very much that way. So if you think about just the fundamentals of even performance management, since that's the book and what the book focuses on performance, you know, performance appraisal, the traditional performance appraisal, I'm not going to belabor that, but clearly that's a broken process. I think people have started thinking about what they should do differently. But within that is fundamentally things like feedback. When you are in, if you think about work as a contract, when you're in a feedback situation, so if I've hired you to come work on my, you know, I'm paying a contractor to come in and do work in my house, and it's not up to my satisfaction or whatever, I'm just going to tell you what I don't like and what needs to be different or whatever. I'm not worried about your feelings because mm-hmm. of the contract. Like, you contracted to do the work at a certain spec and I'm your customer.
Well,
that's how a contractual relationship.
I mean, hold on. In an ideal world, a lot of people have trouble confronting stuff like this. I
agreed. But I'm saying that if you are going to give feedback, a lot of times you're right. People just like,
they just don't
and take the work that isn't up to their satisfaction and everybody ends up unhappy. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to give feedback in a contractual situation like that, you're not thinking about the feelings of the contractor because it's a contractual relationship. I hired you to do this. You're not doing it the mm-hmm. way that I expect. You need to fix that. And that's how a contract works. The problem is that's how we often treat it. If we're doing feedback in work, that's how it's been treated historically. A manager is like, listen, you know, you're supposed to be doing your job at my expectation. You're not. Fix it, or you won't get to work here anymore. Mm-hmm. The problem is, if you care about relationship, like I would never go to my wife and say, hey, listen, when we got married, you know, I expected this, and, you know, I expected you to be, you know, whatever, pick whatever, you know, I expected back rubs every Thursday evening. And you're not doing that. And if you don't fix that, this marriage is over.
Yeah.
If I want to stay married, that is not how I'd approach feedback. And so you think about it, relational context, that's broken. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's broken like that. And honestly, that's one of the things I write about in the book, that like, if you want to figure out what needs to be broken, try it, or what needs to be fixed, what is broken, try it through the lens of a personal relationship mm-hmm. like I just did. Mm-hmm. And think about, like, how would that go? If I use that approach mm-hmm. with someone I really cared about in my personal life, would that approach work? And if it doesn't, if it would hurt the relationship, then you probably should stop doing that to employees too and figure out how to do it in a way that builds relationship.
Everybody listening out there, hashtag work trends, share your thoughts. How are you mirroring what you want to be and how you want to be treated? Very important stuff here. Let's talk about the upside for organizations that do this, that do transform and create a great place to work. Yes, I just said that. Forgive me.
It's all right.
I just also feel like a great place to work. That's a whole nother conversation, by the way. You used to work closely with Quantum's Best Places to Work Awards. What did you learn from these award-winning companies? And we can, you know, I know you and I can get snarky on all this, but really, what did you learn? Because that's important.
Well, what I learned is that what's actually going on inside of those companies is not what gets written about most often.
Yeah.
You know, so much of the focus is on these perks and all of the fancy, you know, all the bells and whistles that it's interesting to read about. So that gets written about and it mm-hmm. gets advertised. We've got, you know, a big slide and ping pong tables and bring your dog to work and all of this. But what's actually going on, I have a presentation or a keynote that I do about this very topic. And I boil it down to three things that the research suggests are going on in these organizations. And they're really good at creating clarity for their employees, which is about communication and reducing the level of uncertainty that exists in the work relationship. They're good at fostering connection, a feeling of connection between employees with their colleagues and with their leaders. And they're showing the love, like they're creating an environment where people feel cared for and appreciated and valued, which at work, that those are the words we use. In our personal life, we would call that feeling loved. And and so those are the three things that happen. They happen differently across different workplaces, but those are what are really at the basis. And there's some organizations that are doing some exceptional things around that.
Examples for us, Jason, especially, I'm particularly interested about the love part. Who's doing love right out there as a company? And what does that look like or feel like?
You know, it comes back to being in relationship with your people. And I know that, you know, when you think love, everybody sort of goes to like, well, how would that even look in the workplace? Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's really about deeply caring for people, just like a healthy marriage looks very different depending on the people that are involved in the marriage. Organizations look differently as well. One of the companies that I've talked about a lot that blew my mind when I had an opportunity to study them and do a case study on them is The Motley Fool, which most people know for the financial advice. Mm-hmm. They're an exceptional company from the product that they put out, but they're a more exceptional company, in my opinion, based on the culture that they've created internally. And it boils down to certain things about like just how they think about people and how they care for people. And it starts, you know, all the way down to in their values. Their company values, they have a company value that is a stated value around, and I'm drawing a blank about how they actually state it, but it's sort of like, it's a value that says like, release your motley or use your motley. And the whole idea, the motley is something that like in your very first day at work, you figure out what that thing is. It's like your own core value. And they put that in their organizational core values to say, what you care about, we also care about. And so there's that. Yeah. They also think about, like I've talked about, I talked with Lee, who is their head of HR there. And he said, they believe that when you come to work there, that it should be the last time you ever have to look for a job. Like it's, they believe they're investing in a relationship with you that should be able to ebb and flow and change throughout and over the course of your career. And that you can partner together in a way to create a career experience that works for both parties. And I'm like, that kind of commitment, that's what love looks like, right? That's what love looks like in a committed two-person human relationship too. And so it's exceptional.
Well, and I think it's also realistic. I mean, people aren't staying in careers for, you know, a decade plus anymore. So I think it's smart as well, quite frankly.
Well, yeah, and they actually...
You know, we're all hopping around now. But hey, wouldn't it be great if we have a boomerang situation in there somewhere, right?
Yeah. So well, and I mean, they legitimately think people can stay there forever because they've built an organization that can ebb and flow with you as you move through the different stages of your life. Because that's what happens for most people is they, you know, this relationship works for me right now, but then my needs change or my desire change or my motivations change. And they all, and so they've created this whole environment. They honestly believe that you should be able to find what you need. And I'm sure there are times where that doesn't play out and that people leave. That happens everywhere, but they believe that they can that they can do that. And they're building a workplace around that. It's like I said, it's extraordinary.
Well, shout outs to them. And if you're listening in, call us, tweet with us, write us. We want to hear from you because that is cool stuff. I love that whole idea of we're treating you as a person and we know that you're going to change. It's inevitable. We all are going to change. And if you're not changing, let's talk about it.
For sure. And as you change, let's talk about it. Like
be in
relationship.
Okay. So talk to me about what the most controversial idea is in your book.
Well, the thing that I think most people will think is the most controversial is that I go after the 360 degree feedback or the 360 degree sort of survey or assessment in the way that it's been historically done and the way that it's still done in most places today. And I call it the most harmful HR practice ever invented. Mainly because in the way that it's been traditionally done, you know, here I am plowing along, and then HR or a management consultant shows up with this survey, and they're going to go around to everybody that works closest with me on a day-to-day basis, ask them to confidentially provide a pile of feedback about me that then gets, you know, dropped on me.
Yeah.
And all it does is, you know, yes, it maybe provides some interesting developmental feedback or input, but it kills a whole pile of relationships because if one person in there decides to take a shot at you or unload some grievance that they've had with you from 6 months ago, you don't know where it came from. And now everybody that's closest to you is suspect. It's like the mole, you know, you got to sort out who the mole is. It's just a terrible, awful, trust-filling exercise that I think needs to be rethought and redone.
I'm actually completely in agreement with you on that. It's just, and it's old school. Like, sorry, but it's not going to work as a strategy moving forward. When we talk about retaining talent, it's a trust deal breaker and a culture breaker, even worse, you know? So one leads to the other.
Yep. And there's ways to do peer-to-peer feedback that builds relationship and is productive and valuable. It's harder. It requires a little more courage. But that way of doing it, the confidential 360, is just awful. And it should be stopped.
What are the big ideas you want people to walk away with when they read your book?
What we've been talking about most of the day today is the biggest thing that I hope people will get is that work is a relationship for employees. And that if we are going to create an environment and experience of work that will truly unlock people's potential, that work experience, the employee experience, needs to be designed to feel like a healthy relationship. And so that's what that's the foundational idea that the book is built on. And this is, I guess, I don't know if this is radical or not, but I think as we're reinventing performance management, that we can create a system for managing performance that sustainably creates that experience for employees on a ongoing basis. So we can take what we think of performance appraisal, the performance management system today, which is a relationship killer. And I think we can actually flip it over and recreate it and reinvent it in a way that it actually fuels and sustains an employee experience that feels like a healthy relationship and thus unlocks people's best at work over the long haul.
Makes sense to me. All right. It is crystal ball time, Jason. When you look into the future, what do you hope we're going to see at work in the next 5 to 10 years?
I love that you asked me what I hope versus what do I think will happen, because those are two different questions. What I hope that I'll see in the next 5 to 10 years is a lot more love in the workplace, a lot more caring, a lot more appreciation, a lot more communication, a lot more support, a lot more commitment, that we start to really, you know, embrace and get back to understanding that we're humans and that we're all, you know, if we assume people the best in people and we care for them where they are and we see the best, they'll often give that to us. And so that's what my hope is.
I love it. And thank you for stopping by today.
Thanks, Megan. Thanks for having me.
Megan, that's just so much good insight from Jason. Jason's a really good guy. We've known him for years. And, you know, him talking about helping people perform and reach their full potential. That's great. Now, your conversation with Jason, it made me think about how we're preparing the next generation to succeed for the future of work. So I had a great conversation with Dr. Pamela Howes. She works at the National Fund for Workforce Solutions, and her organization is all about expanding apprenticeships and work-based learning. So we had a really good conversation about that. Dr. Howes, you shared with me that about 60% of the American workforce doesn't have a college degree. So how are you helping employers today create alternate paths to good jobs?
So we're doing that in a variety of ways at the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. So one of my work focuses are apprenticeship, and we're really seeing apprenticeship becoming a very popular alternative in more non-traditional sectors, such as healthcare, IT, cybersecurity, and of course, in advanced manufacturing, it continues to be very popular in the construction trades. But we're finding that employers are really using this as a viable solution to really grow their own. We're also doing a variety of projects with on-the-job training. So trying to attract people who are underemployed or unemployed into advanced manufacturing jobs by putting them on the job with a seasoned mentor or trainer and helping them get up to speed rather quickly. We know that these jobs pay very, very well, and they don't necessarily require a four-year degree. So one of the things we're really focusing on as well is industry recognized credentials in all of those sectors.
And that's one of the underreported things when we talk about the unemployment, right? I think that we always lose the fact of the issue of the underemployed. And I think that's really important that you're really helping to address that with the work that you do. So Dr. Howes, let's clear up some of the misconceptions about apprenticeship programs and some of the differences. So can you talk about what exactly an apprenticeship program is and the differences between that and an internship program and how employers are actually focusing and leveraging apprenticeship programs today?
So there are required components of an apprenticeship program. One of those components is the apprentice is actually employed by the employer. So an apprentice is always paid for their time spent on the job learning, and actually they have to have a component that is comprised of related instruction. Most often we see related instruction take place at the local community colleges. They have to be paid a progressive wage scale. And what that means is as they progress throughout the apprenticeship and as they make progress, their wages increase. And so we see apprentices who finish their apprenticeship are at a very sustainable living wage at the end of their apprenticeship program. So the last component is they must have a mentor, which is a seasoned person who's been working in that job for a long time to really teach them all the things that they need to know about that particular occupation or skill.
Why do you think, and this is kind of a little segue to what you were just saying, but I've always been curious about it and have my own theories as well. But why do you think that in America have been so resistant to very highly valuable trade skill types of work and jobs, right? And I know that's, and I'm not trying to go down any rabbit holes here between either of us, but I'm just curious, right? Because some of these are really, really important jobs for the very kind of infrastructure fabric of our nation and other industrialized nations. So why is that there's been this stigma attached to that?
You know, when you're talking with parents of young people, they always want their children to do better than they did. And so there's this misconception that the only way to be successful in the workforce is to obtain a four-year degree. But what we're seeing is that most jobs in America don't require a four-year degree. Only about 33% of those jobs require a four-year degree. And so we're really pushing all of these young people down that educational pathway, and we're seeing that they're not able to be successful in the workforce because of the kinds of degrees that they're obtaining, that there just aren't jobs out there in those fields. And you know, a lot of these kids are acquiring monumental student loan debt to go get that four-year degree. Then they're not able to get a sustainable wage when they graduate, so they can't pay their student loans. They end up defaulting. It ruins their credit. So it's really become quite a cycle here in the U.S. And honestly, traditional educational systems have gotten away from really training people for work, but really training people more for an academic degree. Students don't really understand what the world of work looks like, and they don't understand the opportunities they have. And parents or students don't understand the kind of wages that these positions pay, which can be a very sustainable wage right out of high school.
I completely agree. It's a very much needed realignment of the American dream, and the fact that it is still there when you look at it through that lens. And you really brought up an important point of the sheer painful kaboom that's coming with the student loan debt. That's just really weighing on not only the shoulders of those students who have the debt, but just from an economic perspective, we don't know what kind of repercussions we're going to see from that when those start defaulting even more. So it is a big issue economically. So then you've already touched on some of this, obviously, in our discussion. So then why is it again important for parents and young people today for these kinds of apprenticeship training programs? What is it that you would say to them first and to encourage them to look at this as a potential path for their children?
Something really trying to figure out what the student wants to be when they grow up. We know a lot of kids are not very academic in high school, that learning is painful for them. We've got a lot of success stories of young high school students who go into an apprenticeship training program. They had no idea what an apprenticeship was. They didn't know what that looked like. They certainly didn't know what kind of jobs were out there for them, because honestly, teachers go to college to be teachers, and sometimes teachers don't really understand what the labor market looks like. So really trying to educate and take a systems approach to educate our educators, to educate our parents, to educate our students, that there are real viable opportunities out there. And the other thing we have to think about is, you know, the unemployment rate is the lowest that it's been in 20 years. And so that creates a very tight labor market, in that, you know, employers have openings, but they can't find people that can take their skilled positions. Knowing that these skilled positions can pay anywhere from $50,000 to $75,000 a year, which is a great wage for a young person, you know, in their early 20s when they finish their apprenticeship program.
And it's a great wage for even older workers that have been underemployed for a long time as well. I mean,
that's correct.
All across the board there. Then lastly, now, based on that advice that you'd give to parents of students today, what's advice that you would give to employers who are struggling to find these people at the end of the day?
So what I often tell employers is that this is an excellent opportunity to grow your own talent. So you can recruit a young person into an apprenticeship program. You can teach them the ways of work in your organization. They can get the related instruction outside of the job. They can work with a seasoned mentor. And so really it's a customizable training program, while the apprentices can earn money while they learn what they need to learn to be successful on the job. And the other thing I always tell employers is look at your existing workforce. Who are your workers who, you know, can pass a drug test, who come to work every day, who are loyal and dedicated? And why can't we put those people in an apprenticeship program for a job at the next higher level, and then backfill more entry-level jobs with people who maybe are unemployed or underemployed? So, you know, it's really become very difficult for employers to find the talent they need. And apprenticeship is really an excellent way to have a customized earn and learn program.
Well, thank you so much again, Dr. Howes. It's really exciting, the important work you're doing at the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. So thanks again for being on Work Trends.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks, Kevin. It's really encouraging to see apprenticeship programs helping to skill up so many people. Let's keep that unemployment rate low, shall we? Thanks to listening to Work Trends from Talent Culture. Join us every Wednesday at 1:30 p.m. Eastern for a live Twitter chat with our podcast guest. To learn more about guests featured on today's show, visit the show notes for this episode at talentculture.com and help us spread the word. Subscribe to Work Trends wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave us a rating, review, in iTunes. Share Work Trends with your coworkers, your friends. Look forward to it. See you next time.